A lot of people refer to other people as larger than life. And I've always felt annoyed when I've heard this expression used to describe someone else. I mean, why can't I be larger than life? It's occurred to me that I could place myself on a pedestal with wheels inside a bronze cast in a heroic posture, one arm flung outward from my chest. There'd be a little hole for me to speak through, access ways for food, for elimination, little tubes running out into bags. Well, that seems rather complicated. Maybe there's a simpler way that I could become larger than life. I could develop an acute eating disorder, which would cause me to compulsively consume monumental, heroic, intolerably large quantities of highly caloric foods, causing me to balloon to titanic proportions. I'd eat Bavarian cream pies, hot fudge sundaes, bowls of oily pasta, pancakes with creamery butter, waffles and ice cream, and just pour all of this stuff into a huge trough and devour it. And then, 6 months later, weighing over 400 pounds, billowing with fat, I'd appear in loincloth with shaven head and pigtail. But then, would I really be larger than life? Or would I be a travesty of life? Or I could wear stilts, or sit on the shoulders of an accomplice, or stand at the corner of La Cienega and Wilshire at 10 p.m., and I would have a very, very strong spotlight at a low angle aiming up at me, and I'd be standing about 10 yards in front of a high wall so that my shadow would be projected huge and looming, and I'd instruct people to face the wall. And I'd have built into the wall a set of audio speakers, my voice amplified to ear-splitting level as I spoke into a microphone, so people would be looking up at this great shadow, listening to my voice, and I would be larger than life. But what does it mean when someone is larger than life? Who are these people who are known as larger than life figures? Most of them are actually shrunken dwarves. For instance, without polio, Jonas Salk is a putz. Take away his music, and Mozart's just a lunatic. Michelangelo, without painting and sculpture, is just another guy with one name, like Kantenfloss. Without evolution, who would Darwin be? A nature boy, just some goofball with a jar full of snakes. And without relativity, Einstein would just be a Medusa-headed math freak. I was a Bible salesman, traveling around the country. My car filled with Bibles that were piled in the front seat and on the back seat and in the trunk and strapped in cartons onto the roof. I had nothing else but a small suitcase with an extra pair of pants, underwear, socks, two shirts, and my toothbrush. The Bibles were all defective. Almost half the texts of both the Old and New Testaments were missing. So in order to give the holy books the bulk and heft they needed to make them seem complete, the company I worked for had simply added pages from old technical manuals, diagrams from textbooks, transparency overlays of electrical circuits, magazine articles, pages from the personals in newspapers, passages of pornography, and ads for escort services. Now, although I knew the Bibles were incomplete, I felt there was enough religious information in them to give people the idea of what they were about. And the secular material that had been included to make up for the missing original texts was often quite helpful. For example, you could study Genesis and also learn how to pave your driveway. Or read the Epistle of St. John, turn the page, and see a photograph of an exotic dancer with a phone number, which was interesting. So, from my point of view, even though what I was selling was a bastardized and corrupted version of the Good Book, I felt it provided a wider range of material to learn from, study, and enjoy. I was a door-to-door salesman. I'd ring a doorbell, introduce myself, and try to make a quick assessment of the person I was confronting to determine whether he or she might want to buy a Bible or a book that was rich in all sorts of other information, including material that might be considered prurient to some. For example, if I came into a filthy, chaotic house where there was music blaring, voices raised, the sink overflowing with dirty dishes, an X-rated video running on the TV screen, the mistress of the house in tight leopard skin pedal pushers, spiked heels, push-up bra, her husband in an undershirt and boxer shorts, drinking whiskey from a teacup. Well, in that situation, I'd try to sell the book as an adult entertainment guide, and I'd open it up to a page of pornography and to photos of group sex. And later, if they were sitting in the living room and the husband, while thumbing through the book, came upon one of the religious sections, I'd hurriedly explain that most of the material in the volume was so risque and legally questionable that the publisher had included the religious passages simply to keep police agencies off balance. And on the other hand, if I visited what appeared to be a religious household, if there was a big crucifix on the wall over the mantelpiece, paintings of Jesus and Mary and the apostles, and a tapestry showing scenes from the Old and New Testaments, I'd sell the book as the authentic Bible. And if, while we sat in their living room, as they thumbed through the volume, they came upon an ad, say, for a nude stripper in Corinthians, I'd say, "You see, this material has been placed here for a reason, my friends. To reflect the realities of life. That no matter where we turn, we are confronted by temptation and the forces of darkness. And that we must root them out. In fact, let me suggest the following exercise. Use this Bible as a workbook. The fact is that many people enjoy identifying and then removing the offending portions. They scissor or tear them out. And they have found this very therapeutic and restorative and purifying. A sort of literary exorcism that has helped to increase the intensity of their religious experience. Not only that, but it's also very challenging because in order to find all the perverted and decadent material, you have to read the entire Bible quite thoroughly. Which, of course, is a good thing. And when you tear out those filthy and licentious portions, you feel you're involved in an active way. In fact, some people collect them and put them in a separate folder or scrapbook in order to remind themselves of just how aberrant and depraved these acts really are. Sometimes, as I lay in bed at night, in a motel on the road, listening to the traffic go by, I'd reflect on my ambivalence about God. Because whenever I'd see a beautiful sunset, or a deer in the woods, or the Milky Way spread across the night sky, where I'd listen to the sound of the wind sighing through the trees, or crickets and birds singing early in the morning as the sun came up. I would find myself believing that God existed. And then, as I traveled on the highway, passing roadkills, horrible car accidents with ambulances and mangled bodies and blood-covered corpses strewn across the pavement, and asylums and prisons and convalescent homes and hospitals on fire, burning, I would come to the conclusion that God could not possibly exist. My uncertainty about God was further fueled by the illness of my mother. First, she became forgetful. Then she began to tremble and drop things. She couldn't hold on to her needle and thread anymore. She couldn't even button her clothes. Eventually, I had to put her in a convalescent home. And that's when I first went out on the road selling Bibles, in order to pay for her medical care. And I'd worry about what she'd think of me if she knew what I was doing, and if the means justified the ends. Was it right for me to misrepresent the merchandise I was selling in order to make sure my mother got the best possible care? And what made the whole thing worse was that my mother was a devout Marxist and had rejected Christianity as the opiate of the masses. Hated religion. She mocked it mercilessly. Actually, this was probably the main reason I became interested in the Bible in the first place. So I had read the entire Bible by the time I was 10 years old. But I'd had to read it in secret, because if my mother ever saw me doing anything religious, she'd become enraged. I'd go into the bathroom and lock the door in order to read Genesis or Exodus, or the Sermon on the Mount, or some of the parables, and she'd be knocking at the door asking me what I was doing in there for so long. And at night, I'd sneak the Bible out from behind the radiator, and I'd read it with a flashlight under the covers. And one night, I was right in the middle of Leviticus when she opened the door and stormed in and grabbed the book out of my hands and slapped me across the face. And then she ripped my entire room apart looking for other religious iconography. And when she found a crucifix I'd hidden behind my sink and a St. Christopher's medallion I'd put inside my pillowcase and a small piece of wood that a kid at school claimed was part of the crucifix stuffed inside my wallet and rosary beads that I disguised as a keychain, she almost went crazy. So my mother used to hold Communist Party meetings in the house. And then, when the McCarthy period came, my father was about to testify before the House of Un-American Activities when he tried to kill himself, but failed. He shot a part of his head off, a part of a quadrant of his head right off. About 20% of his head was gone. He always wore a beret on one side after that to cover the fact that his forehead was slanted. He had a gabled brow. And when he revived from the suicide attempt and finally did testify, he betrayed everybody. In fact, he named people who had never been communists because he was mentally impaired. He named classmates of his, shopkeepers we dealt with every day, the school bus driver, my favorite sociology teacher, my parents' dearest friends, most of our neighbors on the block. And he brought shame upon my family. I'll never forget it. We were gathered around the radio, and I heard my father's voice reading the names of hundreds of people, saying that they were all communists. And I remember my mother's face turning white. And that's when she first began to shake uncontrollably, when her palsy began. He testified for 3 days, and he holds the record for naming the most names of people who were communists, as well as people who turned out not to be communists. And so he destroyed scores of lives and ruined many careers. And that night, my mother woke me out of a deep sleep and said, "We have to leave right now." And she had packed our bags. And I was terrified. And I said, "When is Daddy coming home?" And she said, "You'll never see him again." Drove through a storm. She was driving very erratically on a wet, rainy road, and the windshield wipers were going. I remember the car radio was on very loud, and she was sobbing, and I had to go to the bathroom terribly. And now, I was on the road again, as a Bible salesman. And of course, when you travel around like this, you get lonely. And sometimes I'd have a brief encounter with a woman I'd meet at a motel swimming pool or at a bar. And I considered the ephemeral nature of these relationships as a metaphor that separation and loss are a part of life. Ashes to ashes. Dust to dust, that all things human pass away, and that only God is eternal. Then, one evening, I came upon a convent in Montana. I was trying to sell these corrupted Bibles when I realized that the convent was facing a terrible financial crisis, was about to close down, and that some of the nuns had decided that the only way they could save the place was to sell their bodies for Christ. And so I ended up pimping for them. I'd arranged their dates with bankers and judges and police chiefs and leading politicians, all of whom seemed to find the idea of sleeping with nuns particularly intriguing. And in those days, I'd occasionally have to beat up somebody who didn't pay up or who got drunk and abused one of the girls to make sure that it would never happen again. And in the course of that time in my life, I strangled a town controller, shot off the leg of the president of the local bank, suffocated the owner of the largest Ford dealership in the town, tied to a stake, doused with gasoline, and burned to death the head of the city council, and bombed the house of the chief administrator of the Department of Water and Power, killing him and some members of his family. And that, of course, only further complicated my relationship with God, because although on the one hand I was helping the nuns, on the other hand, I was committing sinful acts of murder. in order to raise more money for the convent. I got into drug dealing. My partner, a former altar boy, was Johnny. One night, I stood for 2 hours on a corner, waiting for him to pick me up in his Pontiac Firebird. Then, finally, he pulled up. He said, "Listen, man, I'm sorry I'm late. I got involved in some bullshit with my sister and her ex-husband." "Never mind," I said. "I don't want to hear about it. Just, where's the money, Johnny?" "I don't have the money. When the stuff came from Ramon, it was beat. I couldn't sell that shit. It was such low-grade blow. I started doing a little at home, and you know how it is. It was just in the house, and I couldn't see a way to get rid of it." "I'm telling you," he said, "they screwed us. Ramon's the one who screwed this deal up." And I said, "You welching deadbeat mother. What were you thinking about while you were putting it up your nose? Did the nuns even exist for you? Did you even think about the convent? You nickel and dime jackass. You strung out screw up." "You're hurting my feelings," he said. "Look, I messed up, okay? But there's no reason for you to talk to me like that." "I can't believe I got into this deal with you in the first place. After the time you short-counted me," I said. "Hey, man, that was a mistake. I told you I was dealing with 3 other people at the time, and I had 3 envelopes with cash, and I just gave you the wrong one. Lonnie and Jock got 300 more than they were supposed to get. I explained it to you at the time, don't you remember? And those pricks wouldn't give me the extra $300 back. That's how I got screwed, man, and that's how you got screwed. So what are we going to do at midnight? When we're supposed to give Ramon the money," I said. "I'll do whatever you want. Whatever you want." And then we drove along silently until I saw a shopping center parking lot. And I said, "Pull in there, over to the Kmart." And Johnny drove in and parked at the curb. And I got out. "I'll be right back," I said. And when I came out of the Kmart, I was carrying a shovel. And Johnny looked alarmed. And he said, "What's the shovel for? What are you gonna do? Make me dig my own grave and shoot me? Is that what this is about? Are you gonna kill me over $1,200? I'm gonna die for $1,200 of stepped on cocaine which you got in the first place?" "No, butthole. I've got something else we gotta do. You know where Fang and Jimmy used to live in the woods? Well, just head up there and I'll tell you what this is about. You're the one who made this mess, and you're gonna dig your way out of it." And Johnny said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Do you remember the night Bino and I got the call from Willig to flush the dope because Willig had this paranoid fantasy the cops were in front of the house?" "Yeah, so?" "Well, Bino never flushed it," I said. "He buried it, and I know where it is. And now you and I are gonna go up there, and you're gonna dig that dope up, and maybe we can find a way to move it between now and midnight, when we have to meet these guys." And Johnny said, "Wait a minute. You have 3 ounces of Willig's uncut buried next to Fang's house, and you never told me?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, I'm gonna tell you. I'm gonna tell you the numbers of my Swiss bank account, the location of my girlfriend's G-spot, and where I hide the keys to my house. No problem. Let me tell you something, Johnny. I don't tell you everything, especially with that bull with the envelope. So you and I are gonna drive up to Fang's old place, and I'm gonna sit there and let you put your dick in the dirt." And Johnny was relieved and elated. "No problem, buddy," he said. "I know where we can put that dope. We can take it down to Child Harold and sell it to Roland tonight. You've got 3 ounces. I can't believe this. Jesus, man, this is great. And listen, I'm sorry, man. You want me to dig? I'll dig." And then we were in the woods, and I was sitting on a tree stump while Johnny shoveled up dirt hole was almost the size of a shallow grave. Johnny stopped digging and looked up at me. Are you sure this is the spot? Look, these rocks have been here for years. No one has dug this hole before. And I said, just keep digging. And Johnny said, it doesn't feel right. Did you actually watch Beano bury this stuff? And I said, just keep digging, butthole. And Johnny dug furiously. Then he dropped the spade, paced around the hole, and threw heavy rocks over the side. Come on, he said. There's no dope in this hole. What are you doing to me? I took out my Glock semi-automatic. Johnny said, what's going on? Are you gonna kill me now? Oh shit, man, am I gonna die out here tonight over an ounce of cocaine? We grew up together, man. I've known you practically all my life. Come on, put that away, will you? Stop it, man. You don't need that with me. Figure a way out of this. I'll sell the car. Beano owes me $200. For Christ's sake, we can knock over a liquor store. You don't have to kill me. Say something to me, please. I'm not hearing you talk. I want to hear your voice. And I said, you're running out of time. And Johnny said, don't say that. Don't scare me like that. Shit, man, this is the end for me, isn't it? He got down on his knees. Dear God, forgive me for what I've done, and forgive Joe for what he's about to do. God have mercy on us. Joe, say a prayer with me. Come here, hold my hand. Pray with me. So anyway, with the money the nuns and I earned, we not only saved the convent from bankruptcy, but were able to raise funds for a new chancery, a library, an orphanage, and a youth center. And now I just wander the countryside. I don't sell anything. I don't ask for anything. I don't expect anything. And I no longer see life as a series of events in some linear progress leading somewhere. Nor do I see it as chaotic and random and meaningless. I just live in the present, in the moment. If something nice happens, I'm grateful. If something not so nice happens, I assume it won't last forever. Flaxseed, cloves, and some Ritalin pills that had spilled from someone's pocket. And I could see hippos bathing in the river and reclining in canvas chairs along the shore, wearing sunglasses. One appeared to be slicing a birthday cake made of snow tires. It was a festive scene. Then we passed a group of children gathered around a tree from which a piñata had been hung, Then I realized it was not a piñata, but actually an elderly woman suspended by a harness. The children, blindfolded, were beating her with sticks. And as her body broke into pieces, instead of bleeding, she appeared to be showering them with party favors. Balsa wood airplanes, Cupid dolls, brightly colored balloons, sheep intestines cooked in oatmeal, and jars of Vaseline with index fingers in them. And then, the doors of a church opened, and a woman in a white bridal gown and a man in a tuxedo came out, and a crowd cheered and showered them with rice, and the couple climbed into a car and drove off with cans clanking from the rear fender. But the car seemed to veer out of control and drove up onto the sidewalk and into the crowd, hitting and running people over, and people were sobbing and cursing and shaking their fists and screaming. And the crowd began to chase the car as it zigzagged across the plaza, and they were throwing stones at it. And eventually, they surrounded it and smashed the windshield and the windows with 2x4s and baseball bats and crowbars. And they dragged the bride and the groom from the car and beat them savagely and hung them upside down from a lamppost. And then, suddenly, everyone burst into laughter. It was all a joke. The couple was cut down from the lamppost. They were good-natured about it all. It was just part of the ritual. And they gathered the bodies of the people they'd killed with the car and buried them in a mass grave. And then, a minister in a frock coat stepped up to a podium and, in a deeply sorrowful voice, told a story about how, years ago, he had been on a sailing ship and gazing at the horizon through a pair of binoculars and observed a young woman shaving her underarms on the balcony of a small villa facing the ocean. She was standing before a crockery basin with a shaving brush, a bar of soap, a straight-edge razor, and a mirror. And he had stared at her with a sense of nostalgia and loss. And with tears in his eyes, he blessed the couple, stepped down from the dais, and drinks were served. And then everyone began dancing. And as the raft continued down the river, I saw Jesus wearing a pair of water skis, being pulled by a fat man in a rowboat. The fat man was sweating and gasping, making a valiant effort to get enough speed up. But he couldn't do it, and Jesus kept sinking into the water. I told this dream to my therapist at her office. There was a box of Kleenex on the table beside my chair. And then I realized the Kleenex box was huge, as big as a large bureau. There was a Kleenex sticking out of the top of it, the size of the bed sheet. And I said, "What is the matter with you? What possessed you to put this Kleenex box here? And what do you expect from me?" Then I noticed that my doctor was a tall, slim, blonde, extremely beautiful, and that she'd crossed her legs, revealing long, slender calves. That her lips were slightly parted, her eyes soft, deeply sympathetic, yet penetratingly intelligent. And that's when I burst into a torrent of tears, my body racked by sobs. But I wiped the tears off on the sleeves of my shirt, and then, when my sleeves were soaked through, I unbuttoned my shirt on it, pulled it out of my pants and wiped my tears on that. And then, when that was drenched too, I walked over to the drapes, which fortunately were made of terry cloth, and I buried my face in them. until they became so heavy with tears that they pulled down the curtain rod and fell in a heap at my feet. And so I had to unzip and remove my slacks, and I buried my face in them. And then, feeling so ashamed, I walked into the closet, closed the door behind me, and lifted the trap door I found on the floor. And I saw an old wooden staircase with a rotting banister going down. And I followed it until I reached the catacombs beneath the old city of Rome, where the walls were lined with rib cages and skulls and crossed femurs and bony skeletal hands. I saw rotting prayer books and ancient rosary beads, crucifixes of carved ivory with precious stones. And I could hear the sound of organ music in the distance, and inexplicably, the smell of the ocean. And Jesus was sitting there, still wearing his water skis, looking depressed. And he gestured for me to join him, and inadvertently overturned a lamp, causing a small fire to break out, the room filling with fragrant, intoxicating smoke. Must find peace. But where? Perhaps there is a wise man in a hut in a deep jungle darkness, or on an island in the midst of a great salt lake, or in an apartment building in a slum in Bombay. Or maybe he has no home and wanders from city to city. But it would certainly be good to find him wherever he is. Or perhaps the answer lies behind a door, down a corridor, through a series of subway tunnels, and beneath a labyrinth of crisscrossing steam and electrical service ventilators, up out of a manhole into the shadow of a great cathedral, where, in the vestry, in the lower left-hand drawer of a desk, I will find the key to a code in a computer chip which will provide a printout whose interpolation by a group of mathematically advanced Tibetan monks will produce a street map of downtown Rio de Janeiro, where a telephone will be ringing. And if I pick up that phone, I'll be given directions for a taxi ride to the docks, where a blue houseboat will be waiting. But this will not be the boat I should get on. It will be a decoy, and I will stand there and watch it depart, because 5 minutes after that boat leaves, a second boat will dock. I'll be able to identify it because it will be a 28-foot skiff with a hardwood deck, flying the colors of the Vatican, cross keys against a golden background, and piloted by a man wearing a leather circa 1932 football helmet to which horns have been glued as if to reproduce the image of ocean-going Vikings. But this will not be the boat either. However, if I look carefully, tied by a single strand of worn rope. I'll see a small dinghy bobbing in the waves beside the dock. But I must turn my back on this, too, to find a nondescript step van approaching, pulled by a single rickshaw driver in full harness, horseshoes nailed to the bottom of his sandals. And I will climb into this vehicle, and once inside, I will hear a radio tuned to a popular Brazilian station. I will listen very carefully to the telephone numbers given by the disc jockey, spoken in Portuguese. He will give 8 dozen telephone numbers, and I will listen for the one number that, when each digit is added up, equals 57. And having identified this number, using the Cyrillic alphabet, assigning numbers 1 through 28 for each letter a number, I will determine the address of the sanctuary, where I will ultimately find peace. So, it's not an impossible task. It takes a certain amount of dedication and effort, but it's easily doable. The journey to the sacred might begin at a bus station, or at a river's edge, or in a room with a day bed, the window overlooking a store that sells bulk quantity pet food. Or the search for the sacred might begin at a Kmart, in the home furnishing department, sitting in a lawn chair, listening to the Leroy Anderson Orchestra play Winter Wonderland, when the music abruptly stops and you hear a voice on the PA system say, "Would Michael G. come from the stockroom to cashier's position number 6, please?" Or the journey to the sacred might begin at Bob's Big Boy, at a breakfast to celebrate the hiring of a new regional sales manager. There are 5 people at the table, 2 brand managers, an account executive, the merchandising manager, and the district sales coordinator. And everyone is eating a huge hungry man's breakfast with eggs, pancakes, bacon, sausage, muffins, and grits. The waitress repeatedly returning to freshen the cups, adding an element of unpredictability and threatening the psychic architecture of the situation and creating an emotional house of cards, causing everyone to nervously and feverishly add sugar and cream to their coffees. The moment of crisis coming when the district sales coordinator covers his cup only to have the waitress pour the coffee on the back of his hand, scalding him because she's been momentarily distracted by a handsome young man with shoulder-length blonde hair, who's just entered the restaurant and glanced her way. Michael Bolton. Ask yourself, is it better not to have happiness and to be in a state of desperately wanting happiness, or to be in a state of not caring that you're not happy? In the first case, the absence of happiness is a charged negativity. In the second case, it is simply a void, a vacuum without features. And as they say, nature abhors a vacuum. Or at least, they used to say that, because the latest research at the forefront of quantum physics suggests that nature actually embraces a vacuum, that subatomic particles generate spontaneously out of a vacuum, and that that vacuum, that emptiness, is in fact the mother of existence. It's where we all came from. On the other hand, a state of dissatisfaction is an active state, whereas a state of satisfaction is a passive state. Dissatisfaction motivates, energizes, empowers, It is a creative energy. It illumines one's life in a way that satisfaction never can. Because satisfaction asks for nothing, has no need to change, leads you nowhere. Yes, the unexamined life is not worth living, as someone said. No, who was it? I can't remember at the moment, but it's not really important whether I remember him or not, because in any case, he was very famous, wrote wonderful books, many of which I've read. Recall the titles, nor do I remember exactly what they were about, but I'm sure they were well worth reading. Actually, I think he was a Nobel laureate, and if he wasn't, he should have been one, and I regret the fact that he was overlooked. Moreover, I consider it a scandal, an outrage. Now, this gentleman who said, the unexamined life is not worth living, examined his own life quite thoroughly and found it wasn't worth living. And while I was an actor, I played the role of Christ in Tableau Vivant productions of the Crucifixion. It was like creating a painting in which no one moved. I'd hang from the cross, two thieves hanging on either side of me, a pair of Roman soldiers shooting dice nearby, Mary Magdalene kneeling in tears, a crowd of shepherds, carpenters, tradesmen, and women carrying market baskets, their heads covered with shawls, all watching me. But everyone there was an actor. And I was very successful. I played Jesus all over the world and was booked solid through the end of the following year. I was represented by ICM internationally. I had the dignity, the moving serenity, the gaunt asceticism, and the hollow-eyed holiness of the Son of God. And what was particularly remarkable about my performance was that I was actually nailed to the cross. And one evening, when dusk was falling, and we were in the third hour of our tableau, a procession of mendicant peasants dressed in robes approached. They were flagellating themselves as well as those in front of them, and were led by a hooded figure swinging a bell and holding a high, dark lantern. I saw a woman riding backwards on an ass led by a blind man, a king being made to crawl before a beggar, a queen nursing a baboon, an infant on a throne before whom an old man was begging forgiveness. And this was also part of the show. In any case, it happened that one evening, in Spain, I climbed down from the cross, returned to my hotel room, picked up messages on my answering machine, and realized I'd missed my flight to Melbourne. I'd also misplaced my address book, so I couldn't find the number of my agent's country house to inform him that I'd failed to catch my plane. That night, I went to a local brothel, engaged two women, we played Scrabble, Gin Rummy, Pinochle, sang early American Stephen Foster songs, practiced Brahms' four-handed piano pieces, and then they gave me samba lessons, dressed as feathered Brazilian showgirls. And it was a nice evening. I had a really good time. It made me feel a lot better. I liked those women. They reminded me of Sister Mary and Sister Kelly and the other girls of the convent.